Hey, Catherine Spires here, and before we get into today's episode, I wanted to add a little bit of context. We talk about Anthony Bourdain a lot in this episode, and this was recorded in May, before he passed away, hence the present tense. And it's a nice conversation, and I think a lovely reminder of what a generous and kind guy he was. And I hope you enjoy the conversation. Everybody, you're back with Smart Mouth. I'm your host, per usual, Catherine Spires. And this week, we're actually on the road up in Santa Barbara County. And our first stop is with Sherry Villanueva. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Really happy to be here. I went to college here. And I don't think I've come back since then, even though it's only about an hour and a half away from LA.
You're missing out.
I know. There's so much. We were driving around and I didn't recognize this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's changed a lot. So you are the owner and managing partner of a number of establishments that fall under the Acme Hospitality Group umbrella. And how many restaurants are in it?
We're currently at six. We're opening our seventh later this summer.
That's a lot.
Yes.
And especially in Santa Barbara's not a big city. So it's like you're a proportion of the town's restaurants.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And we're all of our restaurants are also consolidated here in the Funk Zone.
Uh-huh.
So we've really been a part of the revitalization of the Funk Zone and kind of going through a little bit of a renaissance period of its own. And we've been really excited about that and wanted to kind of play a major role in making that happen.
Tell everybody what the Funk Zone is, which is something that I don't think even existed in 2003 when I was done with college. I think it's since then.
Well, the Funk Zone has been around for a long time. Up until recently, it's been somewhat of a neglected neighborhood.
Ah, I see.
I think with the primary commercial development going up State Street, you know, the Funk Zone was really an area that had been forgotten. It was primarily a collection of warehouses, industrial marine businesses, lots of boat building, surfboard shaping, fish processing, that sort of thing.
So very industrial.
Very industrial, not visited by tourists, really not even visited by locals. It was really just a commercial warehouse working district.
And were some of those warehouses empty?
Some of them have become empty over time. Uh-huh. Many of them were in need of repair. Many of them had fallen behind on staying up to current building codes and safety, conditions. I don't know the exact year, but many years ago, the Urban Wine Trail sort of took root here in the Funk Zone. Santa Barbara Winery has actually been a working winery here in the neighborhood since 1962.
Okay.
And they really, I think, started the wine piece here in the neighborhood. We're now a collection of 29 tasting rooms that are sprinkled throughout the Funk Zone, which is a 16 square block area of the waterfront.
That's a lot of wine.
It's a lot of wine. It's a lot of wineries. In addition to being rooted in the industrial maritime industries, mm-hmm. I think the wine piece really kind of came into play here. And then, of course, it was really most popular with artists. Lots of artists, painters, sculptors, woodworkers. And that's really what gives the Funk Zone, I think, its character and its interest.
Oh, I see. Okay. So basically the fun neighborhood where the restaurants and the arts are, essentially, and all that wine.
Yeah, and all that wine.
So, because Santa Barbara County makes a lot of wine, but I had never really thought about that term, urban wine trail. It's like, instead of in the northern part of the county or in Sonoma or Napa, where you have to ride a bike or have someone drive you from winery to winery, you can walk there.
Exactly. And I think it's been a really fun way for the wineries located up in the Santa Ynez Valley mm-hmm. to be able to reach more people by having a downtown tasting room.
Yeah.
So it's still a really fun day to get in the car and go out to the valley and actually be able to be in the vineyard and see the wine
right.
growing. But it's a completely different experience when you can visit sort of a downtown tasting room, get to know the wines, find, you know, which ones your favorite are, and then be able to take the trip up to the valley and go deeper into that winery.
It's funny, as someone who only lived here before I was 21, it's such a world that like I didn't associate with Santa Barbara at all. Do you get a lot of like just turned 21 year olds? Like, it's because I feel like wine tasting isn't necessarily like a young person's activity, but here it must be just because it's here.
It is. And, you know, Santa Barbara County, the wine industry in Santa Barbara County is growing like leaps and bounds. And so I think now the kinds of wines coming out of the county are really world-class wines. And so we're getting a lot of attention and recognition from markets all over the world, people coming and seeking wine tasting in Santa Barbara. Most of, I would say, the younger demographic, more college age kids, are not necessarily those who are doing the Urban Wine Trail. I would say it goes to a little bit of an older demographic, like 21 to 55.
That's still a big range.
It's a big range. And that's one of the cool things about the Urban Wine Trail is that the wineries are so different that each one of them attracts a different demographic. You have, you know, wineries that are doing more entry-level wines all the way through wineries doing very sophisticated wines. And so on the Urban Wine Trail, there's really a tasting room for everyone.
Do Southern and Central California... Well, I don't know. Everyone has a different definition of Central California. So let me say, do Santa Barbara wine people go up to Napa and vice versa to like kind of get pointers on how to run a wine country?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. They should. I mean, I always am a big proponent of, you know, sharing operational information and, you know, helping each other. I think there's a very good camaraderie between wineries in the Napa Sonoma area and in Santa Barbara County.
Oh, that's nice.
And also in Paso Robles, which has, you know, a very big wine country as well.
Oh man, we grow a lot of wine and a lot of wine grapes here.
We do.
There's a lot of it in California right now. That's cool that people are coming internationally.
Yeah. It's really exciting. And I think it, you know, the winemaking has put Santa Barbara wine country has really become, you know, a major destination on all
traveler. And the weather. The weather's so nice.
It's very true. Yeah.
So I asked you about your favorite foods. You like a lot of foods, which is good for a person who owns restaurants to actually like the product that you're putting out. But what we settled on, we're going to talk about ramen, which is kind of funny because you had a ramen night at one of your restaurants that was so popular you had to stop doing it. Is that correct? That's too popular.
It was very, very popular. It's our restaurant called Le Marchand. And our chef, Weston Richards, it's probably been 3 years ago, sort of decided to try his hand at making ramen. It instantly became a crazy success. And we had started it on one night a week. It was ramen night. We, you know, thought we'll throw it out there and see who's excited. Yeah. It became two nights a week, three nights a week, five nights a week. Suddenly it was, you know, just we had a cult following and we couldn't keep up. He makes every single component by hand. From, you know, cutting the noodles to...
Was he making the noodles in-house?
He makes the noodles in-house.
So that's actually rare.
It's really rare.
Yeah, because there's a couple factories that make it and everyone orders. To spec, but still not made in-house.
No, and those factories do a great job. Mm-hmm. His whole, you know, premise and excitement around it is he wanted to do every single piece of it by hand.
Did he get tired?
He got really tired and it became just unsustainable. So now we still do ramen nights. We do them on special occasions like Christmas Eve. Our Weston this year did it for my birthday, which I was very excited about. And we sell out every time we do it.
Oh my gosh.
So it's a really fun event.
So not just switching the restaurant over into a ramen restaurant.
Well, no, we decided, you know, he's a really extraordinary chef. You know, his menu now is, I would say, sort of wine country's almost French bistro cuisine.
I was going to say it's a French named restaurant.
Yes. We still do ramen because it's heavily requested, but he does amazing menu seven nights a week for dinner.
So I'm assuming it's ramen noodles. The recipe is really simple. It's just the flour, salt, water, and then you have to put something alkaline in it. That's how they stay springy.
Correct.
I want to say is the technical term
that's correct.
For it. And lots of times that's baking soda. Sometimes it's egg. Mm-hmm. I have read that the move is actually to do a little bit of each.
Oh, interesting.
Baking soda and egg. Do you know which?
I'd be guessing. We should have asked him. I think he uses baking soda, but that would be a good question for him.
So it's the alkalinity, is that a word?
Yeah.
That turns it yellow, which is cool.
Right.
It's a little science thing. I'm so bad at science that every time I understand something, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it is. So ramen is Japanese culturally, but the big news about it is that it's really from China.
in the sense that almost all of noodle culture of East Asia is from China originally. But from like a long time ago, the story is, who knows how apocryphal it is, that it was Buddhist priests who were traveling from Japan to China who got into noodles first, especially the fact that the monasteries in China, a lot of them sold noodles as meals, as like their money-making endeavor for the monasteries. So they brought that idea, both of the eating noodles and of making money for temples and whatnot, with ramen noodles, which is makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, super cool. Yeah. Didn't know that.
But it is a little weird because Japan's food culture wasn't heavily noodle based. And I think that, you know, as Americans, we think of it that way because, you know, we think of Asian food and we don't always differentiate in our brains, but they are, their starch was more rice. So using wheat noodles, two things. One, they got it from China. Northern China eats a lot of wheat. But then also post-World War II, when the US government was trying to help, maybe that word is in quotes, after the war, they were sending flour and lard, which are not things that are part of the traditional diet in Japan, but that provided a new opportunity to make more noodles. So the idea is that maybe that's part of why they exploded so much in that era. There's a lot of things that went into it. So I guess that both Chinese people and European people up until sometime in the 1900s really didn't like Japanese food. They said it was too fishy. We love that now, right?
Right. Absolutely.
We love, I mean.
Bring it on.
Everyone loves Japanese food because it's good. It's so fabulous. I don't know if the people who were writing the most had the biggest attitude problem or the most limited palates or what it was. But there's so much writing from that era about how they called it horrible, in fact. Not kind. So there was this guy, his name was Fukuzawa Yukichi, and he was like a thinker in the 1800s. And some people have called him like the most important thinker of the day. I feel like I'm trying to think of like who the equivalent of it is. Anthony Bourdain. Maybe someone like Anthony Bourdain, which I don't. Okay, we're going to have to put Japan aside for a second because you just catered an event that Anthony Bourdain talked at.
We did.
What food did you first? Okay. I don't even know what question to ask first. Did you know he was the speaker of the event before you planned your menu?
We did. Really what we did with the event, we came, he had been booked by UCSB Arts and Lectures to do a speaking engagement as part of a big dinner that they use as their fundraiser that they hold every 2 years. And when we learned that it was Anthony Bourdain, what we wanted to do with the entire event, not just the menu, but we wanted to create something that was quintessentially Santa Barbaran. You know, Anthony has this extraordinary ability to kind of get into a place, wherever that place is that he is, and get underneath the culture of that place. What makes the people tick? What kinds of foods are coming out of that place? How does the food express the culture of that very specific place?
Okay.
So our entire event, including our entire menu, was designed with that in mind. How can we get things and pull them together in a way that are quintessentially Santa Barbaran?
Okay. So tell me what is quintessentially Santa Barbaran?
So we started, we did a reception that we started the event with, and we served items like local uni, which is a Santa Barbara specialty coming only out of our waters. We serve local abalone, also coming right here off the coast. We had, you know, a variety of, we had our two restaurants, Lokita and Le Marchand, catered the reception to start the event. And they put together a whole series of canapés using local produce, local seafood, really sort of highlighting the peak of the season in Santa Barbara County and sort of the bounty that's here.
So the reception was all about local, 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 which... Gosh, this place is so blessed in terms of local products because you've got so, you can grow such a wide variety of produce here because of all the microclimates that are all scattered throughout the climate or the county. And then also such a big difference between your section of the Pacific Ocean and the Pacific Ocean just south, because our waters around Santa Monica Bay is one does not fish to eat from those waters. But you just come up here 100 miles or whatever it is, and the seafood is local and great.
It's extraordinary. And we're here on a channel, you know, so the waters are protected by the Channel Islands that are right off the coast here. And the fishing industry here is very robust. And we're blessed to have a whole plethora of seafood coming out of our waters directly off the coast.
Did you do Santa Barbara spot prawns, or were those not in season?
We didn't at this particular event. We serve them often on our menus at all the restaurants when they are in season.
People go nuts for those.
They're amazing, and they're super fun. But this particular event, we did not have them available.
Okay, so what was it, the dinner portion of
it? So the dinner portion, we had a choice of entrees. We did a local sea bass, which was delicious. And we also did a lamb rib dish. So people had a choice between one or the other.
And was the lamb from local farms?
It was from a farm just in the Central Valley, so not too far from here.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
And then all the, you know, parts that went with it, all the produce, all the flavors, everything that we pulled directly from Santa Barbara County.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
What about the dessert?
The dessert was a lime panna cotta that was just delicious and served with, you know, various other fruits, kumquats, which were really fun, that came from a local farm, as well as other fruits, strawberries and things like that, that are very sort of, again, quintessentially Santa Barbaran.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool that I wasn't sure how many farms are still growing citrus locally, because we have that historic reputation, but a lot of them got pulled out over the years.
Yeah, we still have lots and lots of citrus in Santa Barbara County. Carpinteria, the Carpinteria Valley, is packed with citrus and avocado. That's really the two primary crops coming out of there.
Oh, okay.
And we also still, you know, strawberries are still really big, not only in Santa Barbara County, but in Ventura County, right to the south. And so those, I would say, those three products are really, you know, just as Santa Barbaran as you can get and as fresh and local as you can get.
Absolutely. Oh, that's so cool. Gosh, what a... It is a nice area here.
Yeah, it's fun.
Were and all the chefs sort of like looking to see if Anthony Bourdain was liking the food during the event?
Well, it's funny. He actually had his dinner in the green room. So we were able to kind of custom build it was more of a picnic box that he asked for.
Okay.
But yeah, it was funny. Our chef was really excited to be able to make something special for him.
I bet.
All of our chefs got to contribute to it. And
wait, did he get something different?
No, he had more of just a collection of everything that was served.
Right.
So that he had an opportunity to sample everything.
Okay, good. I'm so glad. I thought you were saying that you made something entirely different.
No,
I was like, oh no, he's gone diva. Oh God.
No. He was the most gracious and, you know, warm and welcoming guy ever. He spent a bunch of time with our chefs talking to them and, you know, kind of talking shop, which was really fun.
Oh my God, that's so nice of him.
It was really great. So they all got a chance to, you know, really get to know him. And then he went on to give an hour-long keynote speech to all of the attendees at the event. So it was very special.
And he said some swears, right?
Yeah, you know, he doesn't mince words. Four-letter words are usually very popular.
Well, he comes from kitchens.
Well, and I think that's what everyone likes about him. He tells it like it is. And, you know, he's kind of a no BS kind of guy.
Right.
And I think, you know, those of us who know and love him appreciate that about him.
Going back to this guy who was the 1800s equivalent of him, apparently, it seemed to have really hurt him to his soul that other people didn't like Japanese food. So I don't know how I feel about his solution to this. Instead of sort of like exporting it and explaining it, which sometimes, you know, it's true, like taste buds are taste buds to a certain extent. I think like we all just like what we like, and it's not a moral issue, even though a lot of people think that it is. But you can learn to like things and learn about new combinations and taste things for the first time and really understand you like them. But that's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to make Japanese people eat more dairy products was essentially his solution. Mm. And he was so like culturally powerful that it started to work. Japan started, we are in a kitchen, near the kitchen, next to the kitchen. And someone just dropped a lot of something.
Yep. Cha-ching, cha-ching, they say.
So the people were importing more products from other countries and I guess expanding the Japanese menu. Hmm. And also in the 1800s to like through World War II, there was a lot of fighting in East Asia. Mm-hmm. There was kind of like constant battles. So there was a lot of people moving around, and part of that was a lot of people moving from China to Japan and setting up noodle shops. So this was another like sort of a second wave of more noodles coming into Japan and becoming more ingrained into the culture. Ingrained. Uh-huh. and these were, you know, when we eat ramen now, so many toppings. Mm-hmm. And you can like check off the little menu cards exactly what toppings you want.
Right.
But back then, you know, especially when there's a lot of wars going on, it was just a few toppings. Mm-hmm. Probably not like the big hunk of pork, certainly. Mm-hmm. Maybe just a couple bamboo shoots or something like that. What do you like to put on your ramen?
Oh, wow. You know, I think it depends. I mean, again, basing my ramen taste on what our chef has done, been able to do here, he's actually done various different versions. So the traditional pork belly, mm-hmm, with the, you know, cooked egg, you know, always just the classic version of that. He does, again, the broth, the tonkotsu broth that he makes by scratch. It takes him 4 days to make it.
And that's with pork bones, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Just absolutely delicious. So I always love sort of the real traditional one. He also has done some vegetarian versions using more of a curry flavor, which is just absolutely spectacular, both with squash and other, you know, kind of seasonal vegetables. And that's been a really kind of cool twist on the traditional ramen.
Boy, a lot of purists would be so angry about
that. I know. Maybe we shouldn't call it ramen. We should just call it like yummy noodles in a bowl with
vegetables. Do you like it? Then that's all we need to know. I mean, when you call it like a curry with noodles, that almost sounds sort of like Southeast Asian.
Yeah.
I say that without knowing what spices he was putting into it, of course. But there's like a tradition of that.
Yeah. I think it is definitely sort of his creative version of it. You know, he always offers the very traditional pork belly version, which, you know, is really popular. I think he wanted to create a vegetarian version just so that the vegetarians didn't feel left out on ramen night.
Which was nice of
him. and they're both equally delicious, although, you know, one certainly not as traditional as the other.
Right. The one, like, is the expected flavor that you know what you're going to get. And
exactly,
there's a reason why people love ramen so much. Instant ramen was really another turning point for ramen. I think we all know that.
Back to college days, yes.
Yeah, exactly. and so the guy who figured out instant ramen, his name was Momofuku Ando, which, you know, Momofuku is David Chang's signature restaurant. Yeah. And you know what's weird about David Chang is that in 2004, he wrote an article for Lucky Peach. It wasn't in 2004. It was more like 2014-ish. He wrote an article saying that ramen was over. I think he was wrong. I think he was incredibly incorrect on that front. I'm very frustrated because he wrote it for Lucky Peach, which doesn't exist anymore, even online. So I couldn't find it, but only references to it. How dare he? People still and always will love ramen.
I think so too.
So when Mr. Ando, he was a scientist, and he actually apparently his impetus for figuring out instant ramen was that there was still so much famine in Japan. But the product came to market in 1958, which coincided perfectly with Japan's economy going straight up into the sky and people maybe not needing to economize in the kitchen as once they once had. But who cares? People still love instant ramen. Mm-hmm. He even invented the bowl. You know, there's cup noodles and then there's the kind that come in the bowl.
Right.
Because when he wanted to sell it outside of Japan and he realized that not every culture has those enormous bowls. So he wanted people to get like the full deep experience of it. And of course, this isn't a cheat, but it's full of MSG. And that's why it tastes good. Do you know if there's added MSG in your restaurant's ramen?
There is not, no.
So just naturally from the products. Mm-hmm. Because I think some people do get confused about what MSG is. And it's sort of like comes from the, oh my gosh, what's the word? There's condensation. And then evaporation, the evaporation of amino acids. Mm-hmm. It's like the salt that's left over from that. And that's usually comes from various seaweed products. But it can, I mean, and that's how it's MSG is used. But MSG also appears in things like tomatoes and cheese. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it's part of the fermentation process. And it's good.
Yeah.
Because it's also in like Doritos.
Right.
Any addictive food.
Right.
has so much MSG in it. It's what makes it taste good. It's the umami. It's what brings out the umami, which I think is so funny because umami is scientific, but also highly artistic.
Right.
Because it's kind of ineffable what it is. Mm-hmm. It just makes everything taste good.
Right.
Even better.
Yep.
Do you keep a jar of umami?
I do not.
Neither do I, but I don't know why.
Mm-hmm, right, exactly.
I'm not that great of a cook, so I feel like if I just sprinkled some umami on everything, right, it would taste better. That's good.
Think about that.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a ramen museum in Yokohama in Japan. It was founded in 1994. And I think that anytime there's a museum dedicated to just one thing, I should say a major museum dedicated to just one food item, that food item has made it. It's a legend. It's going down in history.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, who knows when people will stop eating it sometime in the future when we live on a different planet, maybe, that can't grow seaweed, so we can't get MSG. And then a lot of people, funnily enough, point to David Chang, even though he later renounced ramen, apparently. But when he opened his restaurant, Momofuku, in New York in 2004, it was a ramen restaurant. And the idea that that's when, like, wealthy white people first caught into it, that made it popular.
Right.
Of course, before then, people the planet over had been eating it every day, as you said, in college. I think even not in college. I remember eating it, like, if my parents were out for an evening. Mm-hmm. That's what I would make for myself.
Right.
Do you ever do the instant variety?
I do not, I have to say. Not for a very, very long time. I mean, now, after this conversation, I might have to try it back again.
Yeah, see if you like it. Do a little taste test and find out which flavor you like the best.
Yeah, there you go.
So no plans to open a dedicated ramen restaurant at the moment.
No plans to open a dedicated ramen restaurant. We are opening an Asian restaurant.
Are you really? What is it?
This summer. It's called Tiger Tiger.
Okay.
And it will be opening probably around the 1st of September. And it's Southeast Asian street food.
Southeast Asian street food.
A little bit different. Not really a ramen restaurant, but, you know, focusing on sort of casual, you know, a casual Asian coming out of Vietnam, Thailand, Philippines.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of grilled stuff?
A lot of grilled stuff, a lot of seafood, a lot of, there's a few rice dishes, a couple noodle dishes.
Are you going to have spring rolls or egg rolls from every country that's represented on the menu?
No, but that's a great idea.
I know. Could you please? All I want in life is to be able to eat all the egg rolls at once.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially the Filipino ones. Lumpia, those are so good.
So delicious.
Oh, yeah. Those might be, like, objectively the best ones.
That's a good idea. I'm going to have to take that.
Okay. Give me a cut of the profits, though. Okay. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for taking time out of running 1,000,002 restaurants to talk to us. It was really great. And your restaurant here, Lark, is beautiful.
Thank you. Well. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Which social media would you like people to follow? I don't know if you like people to follow yours or one of the restaurants or...
Definitely one of the restaurants. My social media is really not happening.
Okay.
The only reason I even have an account is my kids basically forced me.
Fair enough.
So it is not where you want to find the latest information. Unless you want to check out my dog.
Lots of people do. You see Drew nodded at that. Yeah. Dogs on Instagram are very popular. Yeah. Don't discount it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, I think, social media is not my particular forte. There are much smarter people in our company that are handling more informative social media. Any of the restaurants, which are The Lark, Le Marchand, Lokita, Helene Avenue Bakery, Lucky Penny, those are all great social media accounts to follow.
Those all sound amazing. And the Helene Avenue Bakery posts pictures of croissants all the time.
Yes.
So that's my suggestion, maybe.
Full gluten all day. That's
yes. Yeah. So delicious. In fact, we might go there after this.
Oh, good.
Sherry, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm 3 hours waiting for you.